Welcome back, everyone, and thank you for tuning into another great episode of GASB's Bridging the Gap. I'm Eileen Foley, podcast producer and senior manager of digital operations. Usually, I'm also joined by GASB chair Joel Black to help kick things off for you, but today we're switching things up a bit as Joel is actually one of our featured guests, along with GASB technical director Alan Skelton. Many of you who are listening in are already familiar with the term GAAP. That's generally accepted accounting principles. And in today's episode, we're talking all things GAAP. We'll explore how GAAP supports both the people preparing governmental financial reports and also those who rely on them, and how GASB's due process, including the importance of stakeholder feedback, shapes the standards along the way. So let's go ahead now and listen in as our host, Matt Broder, Vice President of Communications at FAF, starts off the conversation. Over to you, Matt.
Thank you so much, Eileen. It is great to be here with Joel and Alan to talk about GAAP in the governmental context. And we'll start with, a pretty basic question. This podcast is called Bridging the Gap, so I think it's safe to assume that our audience is aware of what GAAP is. For context, though, if you could just talk a little bit about GAAP for governments, specifically where it comes from and what makes it authoritative.
Sure, Matt. Thanks for having us. Always great to be at Bridging the Gap. So GAAP stands for Generally Accepted Accounting Principles. These are kind of rules for accounting and financial reporting that provide requirements for how an entity records transactions in their financial records and then how it annually reports them. The GASB, us, we establish GAAP for state and local governments in the United States. So the first part of GAAP, right, generally accepted, is really an important part. It's there because the principles we promulgate are done so independently, and we have gone through an extensive due process with input from all our various stakeholders, whether it be preparers of the financial report or auditors or users of the financial report. We've had an open, transparent process where we've, you know, exposed documents for public comment. We've received input. We've incorporated that input. We have all those deliberations in public meetings. It's very thorough process. And in doing that, what we're really trying to do, and this is maybe an oversimplification, but generally speaking, the users of a financial report kind of always want more information. More information is better. And the preparers, though, of the financial report have the burden of preparing it, right? So they're bearing the cost. The users are getting the benefit. And so the board, in taking all that, being independent of all those stakeholders, but listening to all those stakeholders, is kind of balancing those cost benefits and coming out within the best standard. But what makes them generally accepted is that everybody's had a say in the process, and it's been very open.
That's great, Joel. Anything you'd like to add to that, Alan?
Yeah, I would, Matt. It's interesting because we have a unique scenario. As most folks know, the FASB gets the directive to issue GAAP from the SEC and from a central regulatory entity. We don't have that, the GASB. The GASB doesn't have, we can't dictate to state and local governments whether or not they use GAAP. Rather, the 50 states, as separate sovereign entities, they have the ability to determine and establish an accounting framework to follow, and they can choose what their local governments in their jurisdictions decide to follow. So it's a very distinct characteristic that we have within the GASB land.
That's interesting. We're going to come back to that distinction in a moment here, but first I just want to talk a little bit about sort of how the two of you, with somewhat different professional backgrounds, think about GAAP. Now, you both started your careers with large public accounting firms, not unusual in your profession. But then you, Joel, spent many years at a large regional accounting firm working with governments as your clients, while you, Alan, actually ended up in government as Georgia's state accounting officer. So I guess starting with you, Alan, if you could, I'd like you two to share sort of your different perspectives on the value of GAAP based on these different sort of experiences you've had in the past. So we'll start with you, Alan.
Well, I appreciate that, Matt. And I think probably what to start with is one of the things that really makes GAAP for state and local governments unique. And it's really when you think about our user stakeholders and how we think about our user stakeholders. We think about citizens, we think about legislative officials, we think about investors. And really what we're thinking about when we're preparing the audit report and the ACFR is really about providing them understandable, reliable, relevant, timely, consistent, and comparable information. And why are we doing that? Because we're really trying to provide those users, those different levels of users, with information that allows them to make decisions and assess accountability.
Hmm. Great. How about you, Joel?
Yeah, Matt. As an auditor, I always kind of felt in between the users and the preparers, not unlike how we are here at the GASB, because as an auditor, the ultimate value of the audit report, the report saying, hey, this information that's included in this financial document is materially correct, and it's presented in accordance with GAAP, the value of that goes to the user so that the user has some reliance. They can place reliance confidence on that information, right? And so if we're not doing our jobs well and the information isn't accurate, there's no value to the audit report. But oftentimes the preparer's the one that's hired us mm-hmm. to prepare to perform the audit. So I always, as an auditor, felt like I was in between. So I kind of bring that to the GASB. When I think about that perspective and I think about those users, when, you know, Alan talked about the different types of users, if I'm a citizen or a legislator, right, I'm able to see how my taxpayer dollars were spent. That's what the financial report shows me, and I can know that it was presented in a consistent, comparable way, consistent year to year, comparable with other governments if they followed GAAP. But also, when I think about the investors and they're comparing, you know, making capital allocation decisions, investment decisions across different governments, then they know, hey, there was a specific set of rules that was used by all of these governments, if they all follow GAAP, to present that cost, that financial condition information, the activities of the government, so that they can use that information and make decisions analyzing all different types of governments.
That's really interesting, you know, kind of how the same set of information gets deployed in so many different ways. I want to come back now to kind of this sort of notion of usage rates and how widespread GAAP for governments is. I know that all 50 states follow GAAP, but do the states also require the cities and towns in their jurisdiction to use GAAP as well? And I guess I'll direct this question to Alan.
Well, it's interesting because it's not a simple yes, no answer. Right? You're right in the sense that all the state governments issue GAAP-compliant ACFRs. You're right about that. But the truth is, at the city and county level, it's kind of a little of a lot. There are states that do require all the local jurisdictions to issue GAAP reports. There are also states that provide exceptions. Typically, the exceptions are probably typically based on the size of the city or county government, the number of citizens that might reside in that city, and when the city might be without putting a number on it, what many people might be considered small, they might not be required to do an ACFR, but some other type of other report. Mm-hmm. That is one of the things is there are other states don't necessarily have a particular framework, but they have the ability to do other things. So it's not one answer, not one size fits all. Mm-hmm. This goes back to really the first answer to the question was there's 50 sovereign states. And so the 50 sovereign states can decide what they think the best answer is. The states themselves all do it, but I think it varies across all 50 states about what the answer might be.
That's interesting. So if GAAP is not required in a given state, for example, do you have a sense of how widespread the use is of GAAP for smaller entities like cities or towns in these states that don't require? And I guess I'll direct this question to you, Joel.
Yeah, Matt, our most recent study shows that, as you said, 100% of the states utilize GAAP and 74% of the counties across the country use GAAP and 71% of cities or towns use GAAP.
Those are big numbers, actually. That suggests actually that the majority of these, if you will, smaller entities, these cities and towns, that suggests that the majority of them actually do find value in using GAAP, even if it's not required. So if they're finding value in using GAAP, I'm just wondering how you two would talk about what that value looks like. Like, what would a city or a town, maybe they don't have to use GAAP, but they choose to. Why are they making that choice? What are the benefits that GAAP would provide to them um, that not using GAAP would withhold from them? And I'll start with you on this one, Joel.
Sure. So this kind of builds on what we've talked about earlier, right? About, you know, reliable, consistent, comparable information. And, you know, when you think about that more specifically, I mentioned earlier, users like citizens or legislators, they're getting good information about the cost of the services that the government is providing to them or for them. But then if you kind of get into an example of that cost of service and how GAAP might apply, many governments, large and small, offer post-employment benefits like a pension or post-employment health care. And if a government uses common kind of GAAP methodology to account for the cost of those benefits, then the standards would require you to put the cost that was earned by the employees for the service they provided during that year for future pension payments, for future health care payments, in the cost of, say, public safety for that year, or the cost of parks, or the cost of transportation, versus if, you know, and a government doesn't use GAAP, you really don't know. What did they include? Did they measure that whole pension obligation the same way all the other governments that use GAAP did? They include that full cost of the service in the financial report.
Alan, do you have a perspective on this?
Well, I have an idea and a topic to talk about I don't think people always like think about, but as you think about governments, it's in the news a lot right now, right, with governments talking about the need for infrastructure reform and improve their infrastructure. A lot of governments are going to do that by borrowing money to do it. They're going to go into the debt market, the municipal debt market, and they're going to borrow. Well, what people don't realize is there are academic studies that we've read that will basically tell you that the governments and entities that use GAAP to produce their financial reports actually have a lower cost of borrowing than those that don't. Hmm. Now, you don't think about that every day because you don't think of that as a benefit, but reality is if you issue a GAAP, ACFR-based GAAP report, you will be able to borrow money for less of an interest payment every year than if you don't. And I don't think people talk about that a lot, but that is true.
Well, that feels like a very tangible kind of bottom line benefit.
It does, but I think though for governments that have always done it, I'm not sure they necessarily see what it would be if they didn't. And for those that never have, I'm not sure they know what it would be if they did.
Yeah, interesting.
So I think it kind of one of those things that like it's there and the academic studies would point to the fact that the data is there, but I'm not sure people actually think about that necessarily because if you've already been doing it, then you've already been reaping that benefit.
Yeah.
Right. So,
and Joel, you've got an auditor background. So what would an auditor, how would an auditor answer this question?
I think this is another good point. We hear routinely in our marketplace that there are fewer audit firms willing to audit governments, and many governments are having trouble even sometimes getting auditors. Typically, it's the smaller governments. But I think as somebody who has worked in this field for a long time, having governments, even small governments, use GAAP, then the auditor's coming in, I know what the rules are, I know what I'm doing when I go into that government, versus if I as an audit or audit firm have to learn a unique set of rules that's unique only to this set of small governments in one particular state, I'm less likely to want to come in and kind of serve those clients. I'd rather serve clients where it's a common set of principles like GAAP that I'm applying and not learn something new. So I think that's another benefit of GAAP that often gets lost.
Interesting. I know that one of the things that GASB really talks about a lot is the need to balance the benefits and the costs of GAAP or changes to GAAP that you may be considering. Alan, you worked in government. When you talk about the costs of GAAP for governments, what do those costs actually look like?
Well, it's interesting because it takes a lot of effort to actually produce the report. And I tend to think about it, and I did when I was in Georgia, think about it in kind of three buckets, right? I have people, I have process, and I have technology. And I think there's costs with all that. You know, I have the people that I need to get information from to actually produce the journal entries, produce the trial balances, produce the statements, to produce the report. And I have to be able to get them. And there's a cost of making sure we can get them and a cost of getting the right type of people, the right type of skill sets. There's a process. I have to have a financial statement close process that can gather all the information I need to actually produce the information I need to make the entries. But the part of that is having a process that's efficient, that's effective, that may not be manual based, may not be paper based. And so having an efficient, effective process is a cost, or having to make a change to my process is a cost, right? So if a new standard comes out and it causes me to have to think about, let's say, pension or OPEB accounting differently, and all of a sudden I've got to do those calculations differently, I've got to change a process. And so those processes have to change, and there's a cost to that. There's a cost of educating the people. And the last thing is just the technology, right? Because things, you know, in government, unlike the private sector as well, things are becoming more complex. The transactions are becoming more complex. We're trying to account for derivatives and pensions and leases and SPIDAs. And sometimes you need to take advantage of the technology that allows you to do that. And so there's things that you can talk about within people, process, technology. You know, think about process. Am I using materiality when I can based on the standards? And that materiality box talks about need not be applied to material items. Am I leveraging that in my process? Am I using estimation processes? In technology, am I using automated processes within the ERP to actually produce entries on multiple different measurement focuses of accounting? So if you think about all those different things, any of those things can be levers I might have to turn or change or adjust because of a new standard, and all that is cost, and that's time as well. So I always think about it in that triangle, if you will, those three areas.
Yeah, interesting. It's been a great conversation. I guess the last question I'd like to ask is, you know, having a financial report that benefits these various users that you've discussed, citizens, legislators, investors, you know, what about the user who just like wants to know really simply what's going on in my state, city, or town? When you're writing GAAP, how do you think about all these different varied users?
Matt, it's a great question. It is one of the complexities that we deal with, right? When you're trying to be all things to a lot of different people. Citizens certainly want something different than investors, who typically want a lot more detail, want. And then legislators, maybe they're somewhere in between. And so it's one of the things that makes our report maybe longer. It's one of the things that we have to think about as we're setting standards that adds complexity to the overall financial report. But I would, for those citizen type users, I think something that we don't talk about maybe often enough is that within our conceptual framework, within the rules the board follows in establishing standards, we're supposed to consider the user of the financial report to have knowledge of government accounting and financial concepts. Except in Statement 103, with our requirements for the management discussion and analysis portion of the financial report, we said the governments, as they prepare that MD&A, for short, should prepare it with the user, with the thought that the reader or user is not necessarily knowledgeable about government accounting and finance. And so if I were talking to a citizen, or back when I practiced, sometimes when you've talked to legislative officials even, I might say, look, it's a big, thick, sometimes, often, maybe at this point, 200-page document. Mm-hmm. Go here first. Go to the MD&A first. That might be 10 pages or so, maybe longer, possibly shorter, where you at least start. Start there, read that. That'll give you a good overview summary of financial condition, what happened during the year. Again, the government was supposed to prepare it with the user in mind that isn't as knowledgeable about government accounting and finance. And then from there, you can go to the other parts of the report. So I think within our standards, we've thought about that, and that's how we've tried to address somebody that's the basics. That's what the MD&A is really for. I think beyond our standards, if you went to the Government Finance Officers Association, so GFOA, so this isn't our standard, but they have a program in this kind of report called a Popular Annual Financial Report, or a PAFR. And the PAFR isn't necessarily meant to replace the Comprehensive Financial Report, the ACFR, but it is a program that usually is added on, that is geared towards that citizen user, kind of a basics. It doesn't have all the details in it. A lot of times the PAFR, if you have a good MD&A, a government already has the basics to develop. A PAFR has gone a long way towards it. So again, that's additive. That's not kind of helping governments. And so when I think about those complexities and I kind of look to the future, Matt, which I like to do a lot, and I think about advancements in technology, I don't think we're here yet. Well, in fact, I know we're not here mm-hmm. yet, but I think we're rapidly getting to a place where as things like artificial intelligence are injected into government you know, ERPs and accounting and financial reporting software packages, we will take some of what is currently a pretty manual process to prepare a financial report and automate it more. We're going to make it more efficient and more automated. And as we get to that place, I could see a world in which government prepares financial information. It's in the system. It's prepared in accordance with GAAP, let's say. Auditors maybe audit that information and audit the system. And then the users just go to, say, like the government's website, and maybe they press a button and say, I'm a citizen user. I want just the basic report. And they get a version of the report using the same information that an investor might go to that same website and say, I want the detailed report. I'm an investor. They get the more detailed version. And if we get to a place where technology can efficiently prepare one, two, three different versions of a report for different levels of sophistication or different needs of the user, then I think we'll be in a better place. And maybe we as the standard setter could actually set different, you know, have GAAP for the three different reports. GAAP could say, hey, for that less detailed report, here's what it should look like. Here are the requirements. For the very detailed report, here's the requirements, and GAAP would, you know, adjust to using that. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think the technology is. We're certainly not going to ask governments to prepare three reports mm-hmm. when they're currently preparing one and barely have the resources to do that. But I do think technology will ultimately get us to a place where we can do that. So it's something for the future for us.
Well, that sounds like a trend that's definitely worth keeping an eye on, and we will have you both back on the show to keep us posted. So. Joel, Alan, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you all so much for tuning in with us to this episode of Bridging the Gap. We hope you'll join us again, and please be sure to visit gasby.org/podcast to subscribe and to stay updated on future episodes. You can also follow the Gasby on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X, previously Twitter. Bridging the Gap is a production of the Financial Accounting Foundation, produced by myself, Eileen Foley, and brought to audiovisual life by Patrick Dorsman. So until next time, keep balancing those books, crunching those numbers, and embracing the art of financial reporting.